Good morning, everyone. I'm really surprised to see so many people now at the end of April. It's very nice. We were we're reading in Canto 2 of Book 1, The Issue. We read the beautiful description that Sri Aurobindo gives of Savitri's nature, everything in her, all the parts of her nature that point to a nobler kind, a higher species than our ordinary humanity. And he enumerated them all, the spirit, the mind, the heart, the body, her nature, a wide self-giving was her native act, and how in her atmosphere one could drink life back in streams of honey fire. And he told us that love in her was wider than the universe. The whole world could take refuge in her single heart. So the great unsatisfied Godhead of love could dwell in Savitri as in a shrine, because her nature is vacant, completely empty of the imprisoned air of the dwarf self, the ego self. Her mood is able to harbor the sublimer breath of love, spiritual love, that can make all things divine. In her, he, love, found a vastness like his own, his high, warm, subtle ether he refound and moved in her as in his natural home. In her he met his own eternity. And then we moved on to the second section of the canto, in which Sri Aurobindo told us that until that moment when love met Savitri in the wilderness, there had been no grief, no sorrow at all in her life. She's protected by her divine companion, the white fire dragon bird of endless bliss is gliding above her head, protecting her. So we read that her youth, years like gold raiment of the gods that pass, her youth sat throned in calm felicity, calm happiness. So we're going to read on from there, from line 210. Leila, would you begin?
Starting from that joy cannot endure until the end. There is a darkness in terrestrial things that will not suffer long to gladden out. On her too glows the inescapable hand. Beyond the immortal world, the snare of time. Wonder whether meets the burden great, a signer of the ordeal and the path he chooses in this holocaust of the soul, death, fall and sorrow as the spirit's goats. The dubious Godhead with his torch of pain lit up the chasm of the unfinished world and called her to fill with her past self the abyss. August and pitiless in his calm outlook, heightening the eternal's dreadful strategy, he measured the difficulty with the might and dug more deep the gulf that all must cross. Assailing her divinest elements,
Thank you. So although Savitri has brought with her, when she comes and takes a human birth, she's brought with her something of the divine bliss, which is her native right. Thank you, Don. She's brought something with her from those happier realms when she comes down to help to bear the human load. And that has been with her all through her youth. But she's not come here to be happy. She's come here to change the human load, to help to bear it and even to change it. So for her, as for us, joy can't last forever. There's something in the earth atmosphere and the earth nature, a darkness in terrestrial things that will not allow too glad a note to last long, too much happiness. So on Savitri too, this inescapable hand of pain and suffering and doom and fate, it closes on her too. Although she has come, she's an immortal being, she's come armed and protected, still she has to bear, she has to accept this trap, this snare of time that applies to every being who is born in time. There's a special power dealing with her, one who meets the burdened great, the great beings who come with a mission and a responsibility. A burden is a load. That one, it's his duty to assign, to say which ordeal, which path she must follow. And that being in this existence here, which is a holocaust, a sacrifice, an offering of the soul, quite a painful offering. No. He chooses death, fall, and sorrow as the goads of the spirit. A goad is what you use to poke the bullock or the elephant to make him go faster. And there's many things that goad us into action too. No? That being chooses death, fall. It means losing contact with our divine origin. Sorrow as the spirit's goads. So this one, this dubious Godhead, has a torch. He holds up this torch of pain to illumine for Savitri this great deep hole, this chasm of the unfinished world. It's as if the world is still being built, the foundations are still exposed, there's this huge chasm, and called her to fill this abyss of the unfinished world with her vast self. He shows her that this is her mission, to make up this incompleteness that's there in the world. That Godhead is pitiless. He's august and majestic like a great ruler. He calmly sees everything that has to be done. And he's calling Savitri to fill this abyss, this deep, dark hole with her vast self. And he's fulfilling the plan of the eternal. And in her case, because she's such a powerful being, he heightens, he increases the dreadful strategy of the Eternal. He measures the difficulty which she has to face with her strength. It's like giving somebody a handicap in a golf competition or in a horse race. No? The strongest ones have to do more. He measured the difficulty with the might and dug more deep the gulf, this hole that everyone has to cross. Everyone has to cross it somehow. He makes it more difficult for Savitri. He has to attack her most divine elements, the parts in her, to test them. So in this way, he makes Savitri's heart kin to, very closely related to, very like the striving human heart, our hearts, and forced her strength to its appointed road. She is a missioned child. She's been sent with a mission. She has something particular that she has to do. And this one who meets the burdened great, he forces her strength to its appointed road. That is his task. Amalkiran asked Sri Aurobindo, who is this one? Yeah. Who is this? And Sri Aurobindo said, well, I've deliberately not named him, but if you like, you can call him the Lord of Evolution. He's the one who forces us to make progress. He goads our spirit forward on the way. Andrew? You have a question, Patricia?
It's just related to two of the references. Regarding this one, either this one is different from this teacher, the great teacher of pain, which is talked about
in book 6.
Yeah, page 443. The world's dread teacher.
Pain. So pain is one of the forms that this being takes.
Yes.
He chooses death, fall, sorrow, pain, suffering, all these things which make us realize that our world and our life is incomplete, not yet what it should be. Yeah? The snare, yeah.
We've had these illusions of the bird and the soul, these connections, and we had this reference to the snare. I've heard someone say that Kala, the god of time, which is
He has a snare. Yeah.
Is he holding a snare? I don't know.
And actually, death has a noose.
It is a noose?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, not exactly a snare. No.
But it's similar in its function. The thing about a snare is that you catch your foot in it and trips you up, and then you're caught. Or in the case of a bird catcher, it can be a net, whatever it is. So the armed immortal should be above all these things. But since she's taken birth in human form, in this material world, in this universe of time and space, she gets caught also. She has to. That's how one of the ways he makes her heart kin to the striving human heart. She has the same experiences as we have.
This one may be one member of the immortals army. Armed immortal.
No, Savitri is the armed immortal. Savitri is the armed immortal. But so there she has an opponent. We were reading about it last, no?
She is
the armed immortal. Yeah. So, but despite the fact that she's armed, she still has to accept this snare of time. Yes. She could. It's part of being born as a human being. Can't be escaped. She too has to bear it. And although she has this greater power, this one who has to drive her on her appointed road, he's making the difficulty more difficult for her. We all have to face these difficulties in life. We can progress through them. But for her, since she is so much stronger, he's making it more difficult.
No concession for her.
Not only no concession, he's heightening the difficulty, he's intensifying and increasing it. Yeah. Why? It comes next. Andres.
Why is the Godhead dubious?
What?
Why is the Godhead dubious?
Well, you can say he seems like a hostile being. But actually, what he's doing is fulfilling the divine plan. So it's his meaning is not entirely clear to us. Yeah. Sorry.
For this she had accepted mortal birth. To wrestle with the shadow she had come, and must confront the riddle of man's birth, and life's brief struggle in dumb matter's night. Whether to bear with ignorance and death, or hew the ways of immortality, to win or lose the godlike gain for man, was her soul's issue through the destiny's price. But not to submit and suffer was she born, to lead, to deliver was her glorious part.
Thank you. This is why she has accepted to be born as a human being. She's not compelled to be born as a human being. She's accepted it. She's come deliberately to wrestle with the shadow, with the darkness, with all the unconsciousness and falsehood and ignorance. And so she has to confront this whole riddle, this mystery of our human birth, which is not clear to us why we are here. Why does life have to struggle for a while in this night of matter, this unconscious universe? This canto is called The Issue. And here Sri Aurobindo tells us what the issue is. Savitri has to choose and find out whether she has to bear with ignorance and death just to accept this state as we have to accept it, or whether she can hew the ways of immortality, cut a way through. To hew means to cut your way through with difficulty, through a dense forest or through a rock. It says if she's engaged in a gambling game. She has to win or lose that godlike game. And she's not doing this for herself. She's doing this for humanity. So this, whether she has to accept the conditions of the current conditions of life in the universe, or whether she can make a big breakthrough, whether she's forced to accept the throw of the dice, or whether she can win this game. And then Sri Aurobindo says that she is not like us. She is not born to submit and suffer. She's been born to lead and to deliver, to liberate. That is her glorious role. And then in the next passage, he contrasts our human state, a very colorful and poignant description of our human state contrasted with Savitri's. Patty, it's your turn.
Here was no fabric of terrestrial meat, fit for a day's use by busy, careless powers. An image fluttering on the screen of fate, half animated for a passing show. Or a castaway on the ocean of desire, flung to the eddies in a ruthless sport, and tossed along the gulfs of circumstance. A creature born to bend beneath the yoke, a chattel and a plaything of time's gods. Or one more pawn becomes destined to be pushed one slow move forward on a measureless board in the chess play of the earth's soul with doom. Such is the human figure drawn by time. A conscious frame was here, a self-borne force.
Mm. So in this sentence, or in this passage, Sri Aurobindo gives us five different images for our human life as it appears in this world dominated by time. First of all, fabric, cloth. So this cloth that the earth provides us for our body is only fit for a day's use. It doesn't last long. The busy, careless powers of the universe, they use it and quickly it's ready to be thrown away. Or it's like one of those puppet shows that we see in the village. The puppet master will stretch a white cloth and illumine it from behind with a bright light, and then with his puppets, often they are cut out of leather or board and held on sticks, and he'll make them move as he tells the story. So a skillful puppet master can make them look very convincing. They're half animated for this passing show, which just lasts for a short time. Their images flutter on the screen, on his white screen. So this screen where our lives are like puppets, this is a screen that's been put there by fate. It's very clear from the moment the screen is put up what is going to happen to who. It's all predetermined and predestined. Or it's almost as if somebody has thrown us into the ocean, thrown us off a boat or off a cliff, a castaway. We've been just thrown down into this ocean of desire, where we're just tossed about. Somebody's done that for fun. We've been flung to these eddies and whirlpools as part of a ruthless sport. Somebody is enjoying all our struggles as we're tossed along, carried away by this ocean of desire along the gulf, the deep sea of circumstance over which we have no control at all. Our lives might feel like that sometimes.
I've been looking at this this castaway.
Mm.
Why is it using that word?
Well, because a castaway, sometimes it used to happen, no? If on a ship you were really fed up with one of the crew members, you might just throw him off, maroon him on an island, or just make him walk the plank. It used to happen.
But in this case, we can make choices.
We can. That poor castaway, he hasn't got much choice, no.
That throw us into this.
So that's these busy, careless powers that throw us in. No, we don't do it. Or we don't feel as if we do it. Perhaps we do participate, but.
So it's by our nature and
the universal powers, no? Here the it's an expression of the way we feel helpless in life. You know, we've just been thrown in, we have to do our best. Yes, Audrey.
But this whole thing implies that the powers, and you capitalize it.
Yeah.
And I assume that's gods, are just playing with us.
Universal powers are just playing with us. That's what it often seems like, no?
Oh, it seems like.
This is the human figure drawn by time. If we look at ourselves as we appear in time, it can look like any of these things, these five things. But what he's really leading up to is saying that this is not true for Savitri. She is not like this. We humans are like this.
So we don't have to feel guilty of what happened.
No, I think we do not. People often want to make us guilty. They say it's because of something you've done in some past life. No? And of course, this is the human figure. It's the outer part. We also have a divine part, which is more like Savitri. But until that divine part can come forward and rule our nature, we have these experiences.
Mr. Dhaman, what in Gita says, Basansi Jinnani Jathavihaya, does it mean the same thing that is related to this one, fabric of terrestrial meat? There also your body, you are...
We are our bodies, our nature. It's products of material nature, isn't it? The prakriti, no?
Yeah. Like your fabric in there.
Yes.
The same.
It doesn't last long. You'll have to explain the Gita quotation to me.
Basansi jinnani jathavyaha. That means like clothes, they tear up in time.
Yes.
You are also like that.
Yes.
Your soul is the eternal.
Our bodies are like that. No? Yeah. They just wear out. Yes.
He mentions quotes, I think.
Yes, he's referring to this idea. Yes.
These two words here, conscious and self-born. I mean, they are really, when you meditate on that, what that means.
Yes. But we haven't got there yet, Patty. Here we are still at a creature who's born to bend beneath the yoke. In a way, we are all slaves. No? We are chattels, that means property, and playthings of time's lords. The lords of time, the cosmic powers, they play with us. We just belong to them, they can do what they like with us. Or the last image is about the chess play, as if there's a long game of chess going on between the earth soul, which wants to progress, and doom, all the things that seem to prevent and obstruct our progress. It's like a chess play. And in a chess game, there are these black and white squares. In the chess game, it's 8 by 8, I think, squares. And your pawns, the smallest, most helpless pieces, they start on the second row. But if they can make it all the way across the board to the last row, then they become a queen, the most powerful piece. Well, how much choice we have in it, I don't know. It's the earth soul who's pushing us, no? And it's doom, which is pushing us back the other way, or taking us, just taking us out of the game. That's what they do. And it's just one slow move forward in one lifetime, perhaps. No, you just move one square forward. You've got so many squares, it's not just 8 squares. It's a measureless board. It's not limited to 8 squares. So before you can really get to the other side, You've got a long way to go in one life, just one slow move forward. Such is the human figure drawn by time. But Savitri is not like that. She's not been born like that. She's not subject. Nobody's tossed her into the ocean of desire. Consciously, she has chosen. She is a conscious, her frame, her whole nature and being is conscious, and she is carrying in her a self-born force. It is shaped and directed by itself, not by any other power or force. Shaped the circumstances of her birth and everything. She's in control.
A conscious frame was here, a self-born force. In this enigma of the dusk of God, this slow and strange, uneasy compromise of limiting nature with a limitless soul, where all must move between an ordered chance and an uncaring blind necessity. Too high the fire spiritual dare not blaze. If once it met the intense original flame, an answering touch might shatter all measures made, and earth sink down with the weight of the infinite.
Let's pause there. Earlier he spoke about a riddle, no? That Savitri has to confront the riddle of man's birth, the riddle of our human life. So now he's saying this enigma, he's referring to the riddle of man's birth. In this enigma, in this mystery or riddle, of the dusk of God. It's not the complete darkness of the inconscience. It's not the superconscient light. It's dusk, it's twilight. It's also a slow and strange, uneasy compromise. A compromise between limiting nature and the limitless soul which inhabits nature and is moving nature towards its fulfillment. That's what our world, our life is. It's an enigma, a puzzle of this twilight, this dusk of God. And in this life, what's happening is an uneasy compromise between nature and the soul. The soul accepts to follow evolutionary nature. We will read about it further on in more detail. But eventually, the soul must become the master. But at present, it's like that. The soul is compromising with nature. But it's an uneasy compromise. There's nothing really settled. All of us have to move between two apparently contradictory forces. Chance, which seems, although it's chance and random, there does seem to be some order in it, and necessity, some power which has predetermined everything, which doesn't care about us or the soul. It's blind, it's fate, destiny. An uncaring, blind necessity. The Greeks saw necessity, ancient Greeks saw necessity as one of the most powerful cosmic powers. And she was represented as a goddess, Ananke. And there's another goddess, Moira, fate. I think there are four of them altogether. These are very, very ancient powers, and they have control even over the god. So when one of them enters the halls where the gods are feasting, the gods turn their faces away. They don't want any of those forces to notice them. So there seems to be something like that, that things are fixed and can't be avoided and can't be helped. On the other hand, things often seem to be totally unpredictable. Chance, random, anything can happen. Our lives seem to move between these two forces. Sri Aurobindo refers to them together several times in the poem.
Ordered time is this order.
Yes.
Adjective.
Yes.
The
funny thing about it is it seems to be random and unpredictable, and yet to a certain extent it's ordered and limited. Didn't we read about the binding posts? No, it comes later. Yes, Audrey.
Here, there is a kind of a way of communicating with each other.
Hmm.
And so if one has experienced synchronicity, and you say, oh my God, how could that happen? The
synchronicity. You know what synchronicity is? It's when things happen together in a way that you think, how could it possibly have happened? It seems meaningful. Ordered chance. No? In time, things happen at the coincidences. Yeah?
Right. And the response to this is a conditioned, well, we must be on the right road.
It can also happen the other way round. Sometimes synchronicity is wonderfully favorable, no? But it can also be that just apparently by chance, two things come together to create a disaster that shouldn't have happened. It's also synchronicity.
But that's why I say it's a conditioned response, because people want to.
Well, we put the order into chance. Is it that?
What want to be helpful and support you, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's interesting.
Yes, that's what something that we do, that we see a purpose in things which maybe don't have a purpose.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. But anyway, what he's saying is that in this condition, the spiritual fire, the aspiration, the soul's power, dare not blaze too high in this confused, ambiguous world that seems to be governed both by randomness and destiny. Sorry, Sudha, you wanted to ask something. You wanted to ask?
Necessity, blind adjective. Necessity is already blind.
It means that it's just the opposite of what Audrey was saying. That the necessity, it just does what it has to do. It's not seeing whether it's favorable or unfavorable. There's no will there. There's no vision there. It just goes on. That's inexorable way.
There's also this aspect in Greek mythology that necessity is blind so that nobody can flirt with her.
Yes. Yes. You can't do anything with her. You can't influence her in any way. Yes. So we read the next lines, didn't we? That the fire spiritual doesn't blaze too high. The bonfire shouldn't become too intense. Because if once it met the intense original flame, the flame that has given rise to this whole universe, and there were a response, if there were an answering touch, that might just shatter everything, shatter all the measures made. This universe exists because of limits and limitations and formations. If that intense original flame all came with its full force at the same time, this whole terrestrial creation might be destroyed. And it's interesting that Mother has spoken about this, not that those who have the power to call that intense original flame have to be very careful about how they use that power, because it's actually not intended to shatter this creation. Instead, it's supposed to progress as smoothly, harmoniously as possible towards its fulfilled intention, the complete divine life.
Do harm only if you pull down. If you just allow it to happen, you are not going to do any harm.
Yes, I don't think that we are going to do any harm. We're too small.
Yeah.
So then he goes on to describe our world in more detail. Ravi.
A jail. Sorry about the English spelling.
Have to apologize for the English language. A jail.
In this immense material world, across each road stands armed a stone eyed dog. At every gate, the huge dim sentinel space, a great tribunal of the ignorance, an inquisition of the priests of night, in judgment seat on the adventurous soul, and the dual tables and the karmic norm restrain the titan in awe, and the god pain with its lash, joy with its silver bright guard, the will circling in immobility. A bond is put on the high climbing mind, a seal on the two large, wide, open heart. Death stays the yearning, discoverer life.
Thank you. So this world we live in, this immense material world, is a prison. Across every road where we think we might be able to escape in some way, there's a stone-eyed law. There's a guard watching with his rule book, and he's armed. He can stop us. There are guards also at every gate, every way out. Huge, dim sentinels. There are also cosmic powers. And inside the prison, there's sitting a tribunal, a court. A tribunal of the ignorance. It's even worse than that. It's also an inquisition of the priests of night. The Inquisition was a very terrible system of prosecuting people for their beliefs. So they, this tribunal, this inquisition, they are sitting in judgment on the adventurer soul, the soul that would like, which aspires to escape from this prison, these conditions of the material world. And there's a set of rules and regulations, the dual tables and the karmic norm. The tables, it suggests these laws of Moses, engraved on stone. These documents, permanent documents. This is the laws of duality that rule in this world. The laws of opposites and contraries that make it very, very difficult for us. Perhaps not entirely impossible to the soul, but very difficult for the mind to say yes to anything without simultaneously being saying no to something else. This opposition, the dual tables. So these are limitations that keep us imprisoned. And the karmic norm. Karma is the law of cause and effect, consequences, and the determinisms that have been built up in this material universe since its very beginning. We're carrying this load of karmic norms, standards. We're not allowed to exceed or go beyond those standards. They restrain two things. They restrain the Titan in us, that demonic, exaggerated, ego-centered being, but also our divine part. We're confined within these limitations in both ways. And there are these guards, pain with its lash that keeps us controlled in one way, and the other way we are controlled is by joy, which is like a kind of bribe that keeps us within limits. A silver bribe. It's not golden, silver. These things are protecting the wheel of karma, of consequences, of necessity. It's moving around and around, and sometimes you may be at the top of the wheel enjoying great good fortune, and at other times you may be crushed underneath it as it goes round. But it doesn't move forward. It's just going round and round and round. So these things give limits to our mind. Our mind may try to go very, very high, pure reason, and even beyond, reach the self of mind, but it can only go so far. There's a limit, a bond. And the large, wide open heart, there's a seal. It can only open so wide. It's not allowed to open completely. And there is life, the journeying discoverer, life always looking for new possibilities and experiences. It can only go so far. There's always death to put a stop to its discoveries. This is the prison aspect of this immense material world.
Itself in the apparently paradoxes that these last two things, the bond is put on a high climb of mind, that means that on a not high climb of mind, there's nothing put on. Why?
It doesn't need to be, because it just stays where it is anyway.
You know, but what I try to make clear, what they conventionally say, don't lose your balance, don't lose your balance. As a matter of fact, the seal on a too large, wide open heart, I see these things like that. I mean, anything is possible, but keep your balance, and then the world is secure. I see it like
that. You can see it like that, perhaps. You remember Death when he's debating with Savitri. Mm. He says, you're too compassionate, you're too loving, no? Stop it.
Yeah.
So that's what all these limiting factors do. That's part, their part of the cosmic role. Fortunately, it's not the only factor. There's also something else at work, which is the soul itself. Let's read on, Larry.
Thus is the throne of the inconscient safe. While the tardy coilings of the eons pass, and the animal browses in the sacred fence, and the gold hawk can cross the skies no more, but one stood up and lit the limitless flame, arrayed by the dark power that hates all bliss in the dire court where life must pay for joy, sentenced by the mechanic justicer to the afflicting penalty of man's hopes Her head she bowed now to the stark decree, bearing her helpless heart to destiny's stroke. So bows and must the mind born will and man, obedient to the statutes fixed of old, admitting without appeal the nether gods. In her, the superhuman cast its seed.
Thank you. I'm sorry, while we were reading these marvelous lines, I was thinking about what Tone said. And of course, that's what the ancient Greeks thought, that if you stay within the limits, if you observe moderation in all things, then you can avoid getting into trouble with the cosmic powers, with the gods. But I don't think that's really Sri Aurobindo's view.
Ego tends to decline, so you should not lose balance, especially in the initial state. That doesn't mean that you can't have a maintemperate fire within you.
Mm.
But that should be administrated according to certain balance rules. That is the point. Some people that
But all the off. Yes, of course, they go off, that's true. Yes.
But can we say that this is the human figure drawn in time? This is the thing.
This is the conditions in which, under which we seem to live in time, as human beings, yes, it seems like. And he tells us that this is the way that the throne of the inconscient remains safe. It's not dissolved, it's not shaken. Time passes, a lot of time passes, eons. They go round and round in great cycles, very, very slowly. And as long as they do that, the animal, the human animal, just goes on contentedly browsing. It's what animals do, eating their grass, no? Surrounded by this sacred fence. This is a Vedic idea, that there's this animal is being prepared for a sacrifice, and so it is kept in this special enclosure. No? It's looked after, but it can't go anywhere. No? And the gold hawk, which represents the power of the soul, can cross the skies no more. It's had its wings clipped. It's confined within these limitations. That's how it is. But although the fire spiritual dare not blaze too high, still somebody stood up and lit the limitless flame. That is what Savitri does. So the next lines describe her. She's been arraigned, she's been arrested and prosecuted by the dark power that hates all bliss. She's been brought to this court, which is the court where life, when it's accused, it has to pay for joy. There's a penalty to be paid. So Savitri too has been brought to this court. And there she's been sentenced by the mechanic justicer. This is not a wise judge who sees the truth of the case and decides accordingly. It's just mechanical. You know, you put in the formula and whoops, the sentence comes out the other end. No? So she's been sentenced to the penalty, the punishment, the painful punishment of human hopes. If we hope, if our hopes are fulfilled, we may have to pay for it. No? She's been sentenced to that you are going to have to pay for your hopes and your aspirations. But she does not accept the sentence. her head she bowed not to the stark decree. The mechanic justicer has said, you must pay. But she doesn't accept. She doesn't bare her heart for destiny to give its death blow. No? The mind-born will in us human beings has to accept the afflicting penalty of our hopes. We have to bow obedient to these statutes, these laws that were fixed long, long ago. And we can't appeal, we have to accept without appeal the decisions of the nether gods, the gods who rule the lower levels of nature. But Savitri is not like that. In her, the superhuman cast its seed. In her is growing something which is beyond humanity, the superhuman. I think that's where we have to stop today.
All through the ways of immortality, to win or lose the godlike game for man was her soul dispute, song with destiny's dice. But not to submit and suffer what she born to leave, to deliver was her glorious spark. An image fluttering on the screen of fate, half animated, form past seen float. All cast away on the ocean of desire, flung to the abyss in a ruthless sport, and tossed along the gulf of circumstance. A creature born to bend beneath the yoke, a chattel and a plaything of time's law, or one more pawn who comes destined to be pushed one slow move forward on a measureless war in the chest play of the earth's soul with doom. Such is the human figure drawn by time, a conscious frame was here a self-born force. Across each home stand up a great tribunal of the ignorant, an inquisition of the priests of night. In judgment sit on the adventurer's soul, and the dual table and the karmic norm restrain the titan in us and the god. Pain with its less, joy with its silver bribe, guard the wheels circling immobile. Death stays the journey discoverer light.
One more.
Stays the journey of great tribunal The magic level is suddenly caught that moves the veil in a fabulous timeless wing. A prayer, a master act, a king idea can lift man's strength to a transcendent force.
Thanks to Schopenhauer.